just as fascinating as snakes, although you'd need a microscope, is the slime mould, Dictyostelium. Squillions of them in the soil, wandering like amoebae, until, almost magically, they gather together like cells to form a body, a large animal, and off they go. Paul Fisher at La Trobe University has a film of them doing just this, and it's a treat to watch.
We don't collect them ourselves from soil, but if you pick up a handful of soil, you'll have thousands of Dictyostelium in your hands, and it doesn't matter really where the soil comes from. There are more species in the tropics than there are in the temperate zones, but wherever you go, you'll find slime moulds.
When you say you do work on slime moulds, do people recognise it and say, oh yes, tell me more, or do most of the people look blank? What's it like?
Most people look blank, or they focus on the word slime and get a look of distaste.
But they really are fantastic creatures, because this process of the unicells, the amoebae, suddenly getting together to form a slug, going walkabout, and sometimes merging with other slugs, you know, like black holes eat black holes, and having a front end and a back end and a sense of direction, is one of the great mysteries of nature. How does it work?
We don't really know exactly yet how it works, but we do know that there are chemical signals involved, and that the cells in that mass are signalling to each other, and some of those signals are determining who will be the front and who will be the rear, and the guys in the front basically keep everyone else under control.
How did you find that out?
Oh, there are a variety of things that you can do. Because they're really small and easy to manipulate in the lab, so you can have thousands of them in a petri dish, you can do nasty things to them. And one of the nasty things that you can do is you can chop off the nose, and you can transplant noses across different slugs. So you can take, for example, a mutant that doesn't crawl towards the light properly anymore, and you can swap noses with a normal strain that does crawl towards the light. And if it's got a normal nose, it'll crawl towards the light properly, whereas if it has a mutant nose, it'll wander all over the place. So we know that from that experiment that the nose controls where it goes. And there are a whole heap of other experiments along similar lines that have been done.
How long have you been doing this with them?
I've been working with them since 1978.
That's a one hell of a long time. As a matter of interest, how much time do they spend being independent amoebae, and how much time of the year being slugs?
Basically, they will stay as an amoeba as long as there's food. The signal to aggregate together and make the multicellular form become a slug is starvation. So it's actually a way of avoiding death by starvation. If you live in the soil, life is really uncertain. You have boom times and bust times. And when the bust times come and they have a global financial crisis locally in the soil, then instead of dying by starvation, they will change into a different kind of cell. They differentiate. They become attractive to each other. They aggregate together, a few hundred thousand of them. They can make this little multicellular animal that we call the slug that you saw in the movie. And it will crawl around. And one of the things that it does is it will crawl to the surface of the soil. It knows where the surface is because the surface has more light in the daytime and even at night. And also in the daytime, the surface is warmer. Nighttime, the surface is cooler, and it can tell the difference. And so it will crawl towards the surface, and there it will stop migrating. And it knows it gets there because there's a sudden drop in humidity and there's overhead light now. It then makes the fruiting bodies so that the little slug stops crawling. And it makes this little thing that looks a bit like a tree or a mushroom standing up. And on the top of it is a little droplet of spores, which are resistant to death by starvation, resistant to drying out, resistant to heat. And they can then be dispersed by a passing beetle or bug to other places where there might be food to eat.
Isn't that clever?
It's amazing. And it's actually, there are many microorganisms that have found ways to avoid starvation. And as a consequence, a lot of the differentiation processes that you find in microbes, the signal to start them off, is starvation. And I actually believe that in multicellular animals like ourselves, what we've done is we've taken that primeval mechanism and we now use it to control our own differentiation. That's why our differentiated cells are ones that have stopped growing.
Yes, in other words, so we can have tissues which become lung, which become skin, which become eye. And all of that has got to be stopped and started and shaped even. So there's another aspect of that that struck me even further back, that maybe that mechanism showed the way to become multicellular in the first place, because you've got all these amoebas getting together because there's a need. Well, maybe they could stay together and become a larger creature, and that was one route to form multicells.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The slime molds, in fact, have done that independently of us. So they discovered that during the course of evolution, by aggregating together in a mass, they could actually move a lot further. And that meant they could get to the surface of the soil better, better able to disperse themselves to places where there is food. So they become multicellular by lots of them coming together, aggregating. The other way you can become multicellular is when you grow and divide, you just don't separate, you just stay stuck together. And if you do that, you then also have the opportunity for those cells to then specialise into different types, which is what we do during development.
Yeah, and of course, if you're going somewhere, you can have a front end and a back end, and the next thing you're doing is being bilateral, and you're recapitulating the whole of life.
Yeah, that's right. So there are aspects of the biology of slime molds which are not readily transferable to humans because they've gone off on their own path. So one of the things that they've done is become multicellular in a different way, and so we don't expect that external signalling molecules that they use to become multicellular will be the same ones that we use to signal each other. But we do expect that the intracellular, the signalling processes inside the cell in response to those signals, will be similar because they arose at the very beginning and they formed the foundation to do these different things later.
But after 30 years, what do you still have to find out about these beasties?
Oh, there is so much. There's only about 100 groups worldwide working on slime molds, so we're a bit undermanned globally. And their biology is so fascinating. It offers so many opportunities to study fundamental processes of cell biology, things that are related to disease as well. But in general, we've only got a couple of groups around the world working on each of these major problems. It's because the organism is so tractable, we say, so easily manipulated, that we nonetheless make a lot of progress. If we had more manpower worldwide, the sky's the limit.
And so these little beasties are great models for you to investigate all sorts of things, from nerves to the energy systems. But if people want to see something like the movie I've just enjoyed in your laboratory, can they see it on the net? Do you get slime molds turn up?
Yeah, there's actually quite a number of sites, but the international Dictyostelium community puts some of its resources into what we call Dictybase, which is a website for people who work on this organism and people who are interested in it. And on that site, there are links to photographs and also short video clips showing aspects of the life cycle that you've just seen. So if you search for Dictybase on the web, you'll find it.
The wonderful science of slime molds being applied by Paul Fisher at La Trobe to investigate mitochondrial diseases, which we have too, so it can help us, this work. Paul Fisher is a professor of microbiology, and I see a photo of a slime mold did well just now in the Eureka Prizes, the New Scientist Eureka Prize for Scientific Photography. Catalyst next week features Dengue Mozzies with Marianne DeMaisy, Photonic Chips with Paul Willis, who's eaten too many, and Dr. Tony Harding, who shows you a bank you can believe in, where they preserve brains. Next week on The Science Show, David Fisher goes to Lindau in Germany to meet more Nobel Prize winners and young geniuses than you can count. He produced The Science Show with Charlie McCune on the desk. I'm Robin Williams.